Well, good morning. I realized this morning as I was pondering, speaking about a subject as economic democracy, that I may be treading upon something we really hold sacred, our money, and what we might do with that. And then I thought, you know, sometimes we get ideas and we get understandings of things, different concepts, and we hold them up here in our minds, but they really don't mean anything to us. We just know them. For example, of what I mean by that, if some of you might remember, or some of you might be hearing for the first time, the story of that first century prophet Jesus, when he went into the temple, and he was really upset when he went into the temple, because he saw that the leaders in the temple were exchanging money for sacrifices, and people were giving sacrifices, animals, and the priest would take the animals to the back room and bring them out and sell them to somebody else. Right? And so it was really fraudulent what they were doing. And I might know that story, and then Jesus flipped the tables over and he chased people out of the temple with a whip, and he was enraged. And I might think, okay, I've got that story. I understand that. Jesus can get angry. And also that Jesus is against this kind of oppression, and Jesus is against this kind of usage of what would be a religious house. So I understand that, and I know that. But do I really understand the meaning of that story? Because the day before the sacrifices were offered, there were people sitting around their kitchen table deciding, which animal should we take to the temple to sacrifice? Well, we really can't take the goat because it means this to our family. It gives us milk, or we could sell it for this much money and it would feed our family. Or we might sell cattle, or we might bring a dove, or we might have to take our money and go to the temple and buy something. And there are families agonizing over the sacrifice because it means there's going to be monetary value taken from their home and resources taken from their home, and that they have to sacrifice for something they believe in, for a religious belief they are passionate about, so they're going to make this sacrifice. So what Jesus was enraged about was not necessarily about what was going on in the temple period. It was about what it meant to the people that belonged to that community. That's a full and thicker understanding of that event. And what I'm going to hope to do in the next several weeks is to help us understand economic democracy from a thick position, from a position of how it affects us, not so it's just an idea, so that we can begin to feel what economic democracy means. It is difficult, I believe, to be a citizen in this country who has been given the responsibility and the stewardship of holding democracy in our hands and passing democracy to the next generation. I think that is a difficult task. We live in a country where 70% of the people don't want to be at war. 70 to 80% of the people want health care for everyone. 70 to 80% of the people want better attentiveness and action to environmental affairs that are going on in our country. And we have a belief that we live in a democracy and that the majority of the rules, but 70 to 80% of the people have wants and have desires, but yet those who govern our country do not hear us, to the point when they are confronted with the people say, 70% of the people say they want this, our governing leaders turn around and say, so. They turn around and say, so what? And I'm not making that up. So how are we as citizens who have been given the responsibility to hold this gift of democracy, and it is a gift, and when we look at world history and we look at other nations, democracy is a gift. It is a wonderful thing. And we've been given the responsibility to hold this democracy and to practice democracy to ensure that it gets to the next generation and to the next generation. I'm going to suggest today that we live between two economic poles. And both of these economic poles that I'm going to suggest today are poles that exist within the capitalistic framework. So I'm not talking about socialism. I'm not talking about totalitarianism. I'm not talking about fascism. And if, as I'm talking about economic democracy and these ideas, is if I say something and you say in your head, all that socialism, let it go. Because what we know, what we do as human beings, is when we hear something new or we hear something different, it comes toward us, our brain automatically tries to put it in a category so that we can understand it that we already have. The danger in doing that is that when I'm hearing new information or different information, and I begin to categorize it in categories that I already have in my head, I can miss the nuances of something new. That's the danger. So as I'm speaking, if you try to categorize this in a category you already have, I'm going to ask you to suspend that and to hear this anew. The two poles that I'm going to suggest that we live in today economically are between Franklin Delano Roosevelt's Second Bill of Rights that he was going to promote after the Second World War and the economic pole of transnational capitalist class that we live in between those two, and that we are in a historic time in which our social structures are changing. I'd like to read from William Robinson, who will help put us in our present historical context, so as I speak, we can relate it to the here and now. Transnational denotes economic and related social, political, and cultural processes, including class formation, that supersede nation states. Now, I've got to understand, what does that mean? This man is saying that there is a class of people, transnational class of people, that supersede the boundaries, the laws, and the legislations of nations. Somehow. That means our nation's regulations would not apply to these citizens or to these companies. That means we have no power in negotiating with these people and these companies. Something like that. I'm trying to grab a hold of that. The global economy is bringing shifts to the processes of social production worldwide and therefore reorganizing world class structure. Now, what does social production mean? Social production is your coming here on Sunday morning. Social production is Heather with the choir. Social production is me. Social production is what we produce in the network of our social relationships as we carry our culture through time. In earlier years, and some people say democracy is dependent upon voluntary organizations. And so social production and voluntary organization was a backbone to democracy. Now today, because of the transitions that we're going to talk about in just a minute, the voluntary associations and the population of voluntary association has been greatly diminished by the mass media in our country. Rather than going to groups on, now Boston Legal's on Wednesday nights, rather than going to groups on Wednesday nights and talk about the governing of our country, I've got it in my head, I'm going to be home watching a TV show. Although it does deal with political issues, so I can justify it. But nonetheless, I am not with a group of people talking about what's going on in my community. So the social structure was changed by mass media. If that's what that means by the productions. The rise of economic dominance of the joint stock company and the national corporation in the late 19th century affected class structure profoundly. With the consolidation of national corporations and national markets, local and regional capitalists crystallized into a national capitalist classes. Now, when I say that, do you have an immediate awareness that we live in a class society? Or not? And the fact is, we do. But our sensitivities to it have been dulled. Because in our culture, we can climb through any class, and there's ladders going to any class, and it's easy for us to shift classes in our social status. That is the belief. Is that the reality? These became the powerful ruling classes that restructured society and ushered in a new era of corporate capitalism symbolized by the infamous robber barons, industrial tycoons. What he's pointing to is that when the Industrial Revolution occurred, which was a capitalist endeavor, expansion, profit at all cost, capitalism's perpetual expansion, that we went from an agrarian community to an industrial community, and because of that movement, our social structure changed dramatically so that we wouldn't recognize if we existed 125 years ago, we'd walk around and look, and cities would be different and everything would be different. So he's saying that as a result of the economic structure changing, our social structures change, and some benefit and some don't. He says, presently, and this is why I think this is so important to us as Unitarian Universalists, who every week we talk about social justice for all, we talk about the inherent worth and dignity for all people, and our values move us toward a sense of justice. If we are in the middle of a transitional period, what comes out of that transitional period is going to be foundational for the next 50 to 100 years. They'll be solidified. The laws, the legislation, the regulations will be solidified and they will be hard to change. But if you're in a transitional period, they're easier to change. And he says, today, we are in the earlier stages of the same processes at a global level. Capitalists are fusing into a new configuration of transnational capital. The rise of transnational capital out of the formal national capitalist is having a similar transformative effect on what were national capitalist classes. They are drawn by globalization into transnational change that reorients the determinants of class formation. They are crystallizing a transnational capitalist class. What does that mean? That means that as nation states, as our nation governs the people within it, we develop laws, we develop legislation, we develop regulation concerning pollution, concerning workers' rights, and we have power to implement those laws. And we as citizens who practice democracy have rights to go in and alter that legislation if we feel they're unjust. That's what that means. That's where we are as a nation state. Moving to a transnational capitalist class, there will be, and there is today, and there will be tomorrow, and there was in recent history, an effort to reorganize national regulation, to reorganize national financial structures so that they feed this transnational class from the domestic sphere to this transnational world. That's what's happening today, and we are in the middle of that process. He continues to say that this process of transnational capitalist shift has captured our bureaucracies, our political process, our local process, our regional process. So we now have transnational capitalist class citizens running a large portion of our governing processes. What that means is the transnational corporation, the transnational class, sees the world and takes the investment out into the world at the expense of the domestic. They're not as nationalists would be, or national leaders would be. We would look at the domestic and we'd say, there's a problem over here. We need to spend some money. We need to fix that. We need to orient ourselves to deal with that problem. And there's a problem over here. The river's catching on fire. We need to invest some money to figure out how to do that differently, as it did in Cleveland at one particular point in time before environmental laws got us here. We have children dying of cancer in a group in this particular area. We need to figure that out. We have a group of people who are bright, but they can't get into college because of money. We've got to reorient our social structure to meet the needs of the people in this country. But this new class does not look inward to see the difficulties. They look outward to see the financial expansion to gain a return. In economic democracy, the stakeholders have the power us, the citizens, not the shareholders. In a capitalist formation, the shareholders have the power, not the citizens. So we begin to ask the question, can you have a political democracy if you don't have an economic democracy? And that's a fair question. Then we say, well, we've never really had an economic democracy. And then I might say, well, have we ever really had a political democracy? Those are fair questions. And I thought I would give two examples of workers, of what it looked like moving from the agrarian to the industrial, and also now what it looks like to be a worker as a domestic sphere funds that would send us to college, keep our streets, keep our bridges healthy, and moving in that direction. As that domestic money moves out, what does that look like to a worker today? And the first is from a book called What is Work? By Philip Levine. And it's a poem, and it's called Coming Close. Take this woman. She has been standing before a polishing wheel for over 3 hours. She lacks 20 minutes before she can take a lunch break. Is she a woman? Consider the arms as they press the long brass tube against the buffer that are striated along the tri-steps, the three heads of which clearly show. Consider the fine dusting of dark down above the upper lip as the beads of sweat that run down from her red kerchief across the brow are wiped away with a blackening wristband in an odd motion that a child might make to say, no, no. You must come closer to find out. You must hang your tie and your jacket in one of the lockers in favor of a black smock. You must be prepared to spend shift after shift hauling off metal trays of stock, bowing first, knees bent for a purchase, then lifting with a gasp the first word of tenderness between the two of you. Then you must bring new trays of dull, unpolished tubes. You must feed her, as they say in the language of this place. Make no mistake, this place has a language. And if by some luck the power were cut, the wheel slowed to a stop so that you suddenly saw it was not a solid object, but so many separate bristles forming a motion of a perfect circle, she would turn to you and say, why? Not the old why of why must I spend 5 nights a week here. Just why? Even if by some magic you knew, you wouldn't speak for fear of her laughter, which now you have anyway, as she places the 5 tapering fingers of her filthy hand on the arm of your white shirt to mark you for your own now and forever. Why? The other day, about a month ago, I was driving home and stopped at a convenience store to get gas and to go in and get a cold drink, and I was at the end of a long line. And by the time I got to the cashier, there was nobody behind me, and I said to the cashier, I said, you finally get a break. And she said, yes, I do, and I have to get ready to go to my next job. And I work, after some conversation, I work 100 hours a week. And she says, yeah, I have to work 3 jobs, and I'm lucky that my mom and dad watch the children. I have friends who watch the children. And she said, I have to work all these hours for this summer so I can pay off my student loan so I can go back to school. And one who has some understanding of student loans, I said, wow, what college did you go to? And she said, I went to the community college. And she's got to pay off her student loan from the community college in order to get to the 4-year school. And she said, I want to go into forensic medicine. And I thought, is that symbolic of something that's happening here? And as I read this poem, Coming Closer, I wonder if that woman who worked 100 hours a week and could not be with her children, also asked the question, why? Is this the new worker of our culture? Is this the worker we say in a democracy we allow for ladders to move through social classes? We allow an educational process to happen that we can lift ourselves up. Is this the new worker in our culture who suffers because the money from the domestic sphere is going to another entity? Is this the new worker of our culture? In the 1940s, a high official in our government, Vice President Henry Wallace, had a vision for this country. And when we get to Franklin Delano Roosevelt's Second Bill of Rights, some of the vision of the Second Bill of Rights are in the work and the thought of this man, Henry Wallace. And I thought, because when we look at the two poles that we live between, I thought I would share some of the vision and some of the thoughts of one of the persons who created the vision of the Second Bill of Rights of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, some of the thinking, so we can have a thicker understanding of where this man is coming from, so that when we put the pole of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's Second Bill of Rights and the transnational capitalists talk about us living between those two poles and how that can help guide us in our direction in life and decisions we make as individuals in a church, again, I thought I'd help us get a thicker understanding of how this man, Vice President Henry Wallace, thought. And I'm going to share some thoughts of his about the land from 1941 and his vision for our country from 1934. The land. Everything is made up of our mother, the earth. Human beings are part of the living landscape, made of the same natural processes and laws. His body, his thoughts, and his spirit are the products of the landscape. The sun, the soil, the wind, the air are all part of us, all part of being human. We are slowly learning to think in terms of a new science, 1941, called ecology, in terms of the inevitable relationships to recognize that all living things under the sun, the clouds, the rocks, the soil, the streams, and the people, and the spirit of the people are all of the same concern in a talk called Soil Defense. People in the cities may forget the soil for as long as 100 years, but Mother Nature's memory is long, and she will not let them forget indefinitely. The soil is the mother of humans, and if we forget her, life eventually weakens. Can you imagine that being part of our economic policy beginning in 1945? That was part of his vision. In religion, connecting religion and economics. Here's what he has to say. Every minister should be given a course in economics against the background of the prophets and the Sermon on the Mount. So far as the economics of the situation is concerned, Isaiah and the modern economists who talk about increasing the consumer's purchasing power are recommending the same cure for hard times. The cure is simply that a greater percentage of income of the nation be turned back to the mass of the people. We can afford to spend time in meditating on the principles from that reformist leader in Palestine some 2,600 years ago, the prophet Isaiah. I think the church should be afire today with keenness of its desire to bring about social justice. What if all the churches in our land today had that vision and had been practicing that vision for the last 60 years? That was his vision, Vice President of the United States of America. I always believe that if you envision something that hasn't been, that can be, and bring it into being, That is a tremendously worthwhile thing to do. Our utopias are blueprints for our future civilization, and as such, airy structures, though they are, they really play a bigger part in the progress of man than our more material structures of brick and steel. The habit of building utopias shows to a degree whether our race is made up of dull, spirited bipeds or whether it is made up of men and women who want to enjoy the full savory of existence that comes only when they feel themselves working with the forces of nature to remake the world nearer to their heart's desire. The machinery will carry out the Sermon on the Mount as well as the present social machinery carries out and intensifies the law of the jungle. We have it in our political heritage, the roots that connect us to that vision. It's there. It's in us. It's not 60 years old. There has been a great effort, as I look at our nation and our mass media, to move us away from that vision. Henry Wallace was sacrificed in 1944, and Henry Truman became vice president, knowing that Roosevelt was probably going to die and that Henry Truman would be the next president of the United States of America. There was a great effort not to make Henry Wallace the next president of the United States of America. You can catch the spirit of how he would have dealt with foreign trade and foreign policy in this story. The rubber plantations were not producing fast enough for the needs of our nation and war needs. And Henry Wallace said, well, when you look at the country, there's malnutrition, there's malaria. He said, the population suffers. He said, what we need to do is help those folks become a healthier population so that production would increase. Now, he's looking out for his interest, gaining the product he wants, but he also has some sense, how can we help these folks be healthier and live a better life, and we could be mutual. And it comes under Roosevelt's a good neighbor policy. It had that philosophy of, some would say, generosity. Some might say a different form of selfishness. I'm going to say generosity. He was met with such a force opposing him that that's what prevented him from becoming the next president, possibly. That the forces in our governing processes said no to creating and participating in a healthier population where that product was coming to us. They said no to that. The malnutrition is okay. The malaria is okay. We just need more product. But it is within the blood of the people of this nation to say, can we bring more food and medicine to those people? It is within us to operate out of the spirit of generosity and out of the spirit of kindness as we trade with other nations. When we do that on this continuum between the transnational capitalist class and Franklin Delano Roosevelt's Second Bill of Rights, we begin to lean toward the Second Bill of Rights. We begin to lean toward economic democracy, because that is what is in our blood when we look at 70% of the people in this nation would rather see income more fairly distributed throughout our nation. We are there as a people. That's where we are. But somehow, we keep drifting toward the robbing of the domestic sphere. We keep drifting toward the transnational class. I think Henry Wallace teaches us this, that economics is a religious issue. It is a spiritual issue that affects our daily lives and how we're going to live every day. That's what he has to teach us. When I read that, I said, and I'll have to go check, because you see, this man must be a Unitarian Universalist, but probably not. I don't know. But he had those values. our values. And when we continue to try to understand what economic democracy means, eventually it will be more than just an idea up here, but it'll be something we can feel. We will be able to have empathy for the woman behind the cash register for 100 hours a week to repay her student debt from community college. From the woman who's working 5 nights a week at the factory. From the woman who's working in the factory in China, taken from her home in a factory that's surrounded by fence with armed guards. We need to feel economic democracy, not just know it. We need to know that economic democracy is a religious and a spiritual issue, not just an economic issue that deals with regulation and legislation. It is about our spirit. And I hope that as we continue this discussion, that our spirit will enliven and we'll begin to incorporate understanding of democracy and understanding of the economic policies from a heart perspective, not just from a pocket perspective.
Do we have one or two brief comments or questions?
Do you really think that, I know one of the issues or one of the themes or whatever you're talking about is investment or flow of capital basically out of the domestic sector through these transnational corporations into other nations, but do you really think that doesn't in the end provide any benefit back to the domestic?
I truly believe that is not this group's concern. They're not doing this to come back and recreate and strengthen the middle class. From what I'm reading and studying, not just from my observation, because the regulations that are being put in place, the trade agreements such as NAFTA that are being put in place, don't have the strengthening of the middle class for our country or the countries that we're signing with as a concern within the document itself.
But you don't believe that any of that comes out in the wash at the end?
Well, how many generations of women will have to work 100 hours at the convenience store before that happens, or is there a better way to get there?
Well, I
don't have that answer.
Way to get there, but so far it's always been the case that hard work has paid off in the end, 5 generations down the line for my family, but it does pay off.
I'm not arguing under, and that answer is yet to be questioned, under the national economics, under a strong nation state, where we have a social contract, is what you're talking about. For 5 generations, FDR, there's been a social contract between business and citizens, and in that social contract, this harder work you're referring to has paid off. While we're in this transition of going to transnational capitalist class, because we're in a transition, the social contract under the time and era of that you were talking about where hard work paid off, and these international trade agreements, that social contract's not included. And what I'm suggesting is, as citizens, we want that included. We're not necessarily against expansion and economic growth, but we want human rights. We want that social contract. We want pensions. We want health care. We want the people that these corporations are operating in. We want some sense of democracy in that country so they can have some sense of self-determination. So it's not an over and against don't do this. It's doing this with strong national boundaries where the democratic process in our country, we still have some say, and there's many examples where NAFTA has overruled local democracy in our country and other countries. I can give you those examples. And what I'm saying is no to that. I'm okay with the international trade treaty and commerce with other countries. Absolutely necessary. From my perspective, necessary for world peace to have commerce moving throughout and have those interlocking. But when it's not done through democracy, generally it's done through tyranny. And then when it's done through tyranny, then we have war and insurgencies and we have those kind of problems. So it's not we're going to stay and hold fight for this old way. It's that as we make these transitions, we don't want to give up any rights. We just want to be more inclusive, but we want to be inclusive in such a way we don't rob you of your rights in this other country so that I can have more rights in this country. So it's not an over and against that I'm promoting. But thank you for the question, because it helps me clarify.
Yes, Mike?
A shock one, anyway. Sure. Unquestionably, over the past 3 or 4 decades, economic inequality has drastically increased to the point today where the difference between the haves and have-nots is greater than it has been in our lifetime.
The best in the years, the best balance we've had for the working person to have purchasing power and such, I believe, was 1972, somewhere in the early 70s. And since then, it has become less. We have less power. That middle class group has less power, purchasing power, and also then political power.